Kenosha, 65 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you'll hear a brand new interview I just recorded with a much-decorated war correspondent. In part two, we're going to be touching on the important issue of hazing in athletic programs. Here's part one of today's program. I'm not sure there is any occupation on the face of the earth quite as challenging as that of the war correspondent. And certainly we get a taste of what that life is like from an extraordinary new memoir written by Jane Ferguson, an award-winning war correspondent. Her book is titled No Ordinary Assignment. And in this book, Jane Ferguson tells us about the harrowing experience that she has had all over the world, covering war and conflict in places like Yemen and Afghanistan and Syria and Somalia and the Ukraine. And it is a story that is told with bracing, unstinting honesty. And we get a sense not only of the incredible difficulty of doing this kind of work and also the importance of doing this work well, but we also are reminded again and again of the deepest consequences of war, the way in which war impacts in such a brutal way, not just the specific and official combatants in that war, but also the civilians, in a sense, caught in the crossfire. This is part of the story that she tells so well in her memoir, as she has told it in her award-winning work as a war correspondent. Again, the book is titled No Ordinary Assignment, a memoir published by Mariner. Jane Ferguson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me on here.
I'm really honored to be speaking with you. Your book tells us some interesting and difficult things about your childhood growing up in Northern Ireland. And I suspect that one of the reasons why you tell us about your childhood and what made it in so many ways a hard childhood is not just for the sake of kind of giving a complete chronicle of your life up to this point, but also because that surely has something to do with the kind of work that you have gone on to do and how well you have been able to do that work. Tell our listeners about growing up in Northern Ireland towards the tail end of what is sometimes known as the Troubles. Tell us what life was like and, in a sense, its lasting impact upon you.
Sure. I mean, I do think you hit the nail on the head there in terms of, like, why I would include so much deeply personal detail in my book, because I outline at the very beginning that I want to answer, in writing this book, the question that I'm asked all the time, which is, why would you do this kind of work? What makes people like you go out and do this? And when you really start to connect the dots backwards in your life, you know, it's personal. The way we live our lives, the choices that we make as adults, so much of that we can really trace back to our origin story and where we were when we were being formed and created. And so because I wanted to write a story about a person and not just about a career, I did have to dig very deep. And going back to Northern Ireland, I do talk about being a little girl, growing up in a very, very rural Northern Ireland on a small farm, in a family that was somewhat chaotic and in a sort of like tough environment there, and not really feeling like I fit in, feeling like a little bit out of place everywhere I was, having a lot of wanderlust at the wider world, you know, reading books and staring at atlases and just kind of absolutely really taken by the idea of going out into the wider world and exploring. But at the same time, I'm growing up not only within a sort of chaotic family environment, but also a wider conflict in Northern Ireland, as you have said, called the Troubles. Now, the Troubles, of course, I'm sure many of the listeners have some sort of understanding on a memory of Northern Ireland in the 80s and 70s, the 80s and 90s when I was growing up there. The conflict had sort of started really in the 70s, this armed uprising against British rule by elements of the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. And I was growing up in effectively just outside of the last Protestant village before you got to incredibly wild IRA heartlands in South Armagh. So it was often referred to as bandit country down there. And you know, it's very hard for me to look back and not see this little girl on a farm filled with stories about how in the hills around us were IRA insurgents. That's certainly not a word we used back then. But then I find myself as an adult throughout so much of my life coming to try to understand insurgents. I spent a ton of my career really focused on understanding and spending time with insurgencies, whether it's Hamas or the Taliban or Hezbollah or rebels in Darfur. And I, you know, whenever you sit down to write your story, you do see these connections with your childhood. You know, and again, I write in the book that you really do think when you're a child, you tend to normalize everything. And I thought everybody drove through military checkpoints when they drove down the road. And I thought it was perfectly normal for military helicopters to land in your dad's field. So I was very much so growing up around this sort of insurgency violence in Northern Ireland, where there were assassinations. You know, write about this in the book, an assassination attempt on a family member of mine. And the impact that this conflict was having on individuals and families was playing out in front of me as a little girl as I was sort of becoming a person.
Hmm. And I know you also talk about sometimes being close at hand when the family and or friends were listening to the radio and to accounts from various war correspondents, and probably that planted a seed as well. You tell us that a post-college internship with the BBC didn't really end up leading to anything, but then your dear Aunt Fanny, someone who was a real provided for you kind of a place of refuge and a source of encouragement in those really difficult years of your childhood, gave you quite a generous check and told you to please use it for something fun. Explain to our listeners what you did with this check that you were given by your Aunt Fanny.
Well, it was Aunt Fanny was, you know, she was actually my great aunt's best friend. She was an honorary aunt in the family. It's very common culturally where I come from to call someone your Aunt Fanny. And she was someone, like you've said, who I spent all my, you know, so much of my summers at her house by the coast. And she was an elderly lady who'd really, you know, become a mother figure to me. And she had no kids of her own. She'd never married. And she was basically, you know, approaching a stage in her life where she was really keen to use her money to help the people that she knew around her, because, you know, she didn't have kids to leave her wealth to. And so she wrote me a check. It was £3,000, so about $4,500 at the time, and didn't say anything, just put it in the mail to me straight out of college. I just finished this internship, which I hadn't managed to get a job at the end of it. And she said to me, do something fun with it. And I had been dreaming of moving to the Middle East and traveling and learning Arabic and studying. And And so that's what I did. I bought a ticket on Yemeni Airways to Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, and I registered at a school where there were lots of, a few other Westerners there studying Arabic, and I settled into that. You know, don't forget this was sort of the start of the financial crisis. So finding a job in journalism was so incredibly hard. All of the newspapers were hemorrhaging money. Many of them were folding. The broadcasters that I'd grown up watching, like the BBC, where I dreamed of working, were having to lay off hundreds of staff. And so it was so hard to find any way into the industry. Every door was kind of shutting. And I really wasn't sure how I was going to make these dreams a reality. The only thing I'd ever really wanted since I was a little girl. And so when Fanny sent me that money, I realized that I could at least move forward. You know, so many times in my life, I haven't known how I'm going to move beyond that one point. But all I need is this one step in front of me. And so I took it and I flew to Yemen.
Hmm. I was going to ask, why Yemen? Why studying Arabic? Was it that was a place where you saw opportunity for yourself? Or was there something else that was drawing you to that particular part of the world?
Well, I knew that I wanted to cover major geopolitical stories around the world. I've been drawn to those who tell stories from conflict zones. You know, these are stories that impact millions and millions of people. So, you know, 9/11 happened when I was still in high school in Northern Ireland. And so that's where so much of the news was coming from. And so I on the one hand, I knew that's where a lot of the war reporting was happening. But on the other hand, I'd also grown up reading, you know, books by British explorers and adventurers and people like Dame Freya Stark. And I'd been fascinated by both Africa and the Middle East as regions. And I had taken some Arabic lessons in college, but they were in classroom settings. And, you know, it was very hard to learn without the immersive experience. And so a lot of, when I did a little bit of research online, a lot of young people were studying in Beirut, Damascus, Cairo, or Yemen. And to be honest with you, at the time, I had this one check from Fanny, and it was pretty much all I had in the world. And studying in Yemen was much cheaper than studying in the other cities. And I thought, if I go there, I can stay longer. And then when I looked into it, I realized how Yemen was so intoxicating and fascinating as a culture, much, much, much more off the beaten track for travelers. And that really, really appealed to me. It had its own extremely unique culture. So I was really drawn in.
We're speaking with Jane Ferguson, the author of No Ordinary Assignment, a memoir. Jane Ferguson, an award-winning war correspondent, and this book has just been published by Mariner. So you end up in Dubai and get a job as an assistant sports reporter, of all things, at the Gulf News. And it sounds like it was a happy, fulfilling life in some respects, and yet one which ultimately left you dissatisfied. Explain to our listeners the moment, in a sense, when the bubble burst and you realized this is not exactly where you wanted to be, or more importantly, not what you wanted to be doing with your life.
Sure. I mean, I had gotten a job in, you know, as the financial crisis had impacted so much of the Western world, it hadn't quite reached Dubai yet and the Middle East and much of the East yet. And so I got a job at a newspaper in Dubai, an English language newspaper, which was a sort of regional paper in the Middle East. And I had worked my way up. I'd been very, very fortunate to have been able to have these opportunities. I started, like you say, as a sub-editor on the sports section. I was, you know, basically fixing spelling mistakes and making cups of coffee and working shifts. And I'd worked my way up to being a business features writer, which was a great job, you know. I mean, to be 24, and I had a lovely life in Dubai. I had a beautiful apartment, and I had a sports car, I could see that I had a future as a business reporter in that part of the world, and I could see that it was something that I could see my life starting to unfold in that direction. And I write about in the book how one day I was I was at a car, a Mazda car dealership where, you know, because it was part of my beat, I would cover any kind of like, you know, industry trends in the region and in the UAE. And, you know, I just couldn't shake the feeling that however comfortable and lovely this life was that I had been blessed with, it was absolutely not what that little girl on that farm in Northern Ireland had dreamed of. You know, I thought I was going to be off. I'd read about correspondents who had been off in Tiananmen Square when the attacks happened by the Chinese government. They were able to document that kind of history and really correct a record on what had happened. I thought that I would be in Afghanistan, you know, reporting on that country's attempts to really build democratic institutions. I had pictured my life so differently, and I got this sort of sense of panic. Of course, I laugh at it now because I was 24 years old. I had this impatience that time was somehow running out. And I write about this, how I just couldn't, in that moment, I'm watching these cars and interviewing Japanese business executives, and I just think to myself, I can't wait another second, because I didn't go to an Ivy League school. I didn't have a particularly prestigious, I didn't have family with connections. I didn't know how to get from where I was to where I wanted to be. But I knew that if I just waited around, it wasn't going to find me. Hmm. So I kind of had this instinct that I had to act. And I get in my car, and I drive to Dubai Airport, Terminal 2, which is where a lot of the regional flights go. And, you know, I asked around for, you know, where were the offices for the flights for the airlines that fly to Afghanistan. I booked a ticket. And I just knew that if I acted, if I did, again, if I could just do one thing that would push me forward, I would figure it out.
Well, figure it out you ultimately did, of course. Right around this time, I think it was maybe shortly after you had purchased that ticket to Afghanistan and made your way there, but I don't think you had maybe yet begun your work as a war correspondent in earnest, you had the opportunity to meet someone who is something of a legend in the business, Tim Page, very well known for his outstanding work as a war photographer during the Vietnam War. And he gave you advice that you seem to have taken very much to heart, because really what he beseeched you to do has been a hallmark of your reporting ever since. Tell us about this encounter with Tim Page and what he advised you to focus on in the work that you were about to begin as a war correspondent.
Well, when I got to Afghanistan, the newspaper I was working with agreed to run some of my pieces from there, and so I basically just booked vacation time, paid for my own travel, and I was scrambling around in the first couple of days trying to figure out what to write. And I was such a rookie. I had no idea that it was Eid, which is the end of the holy month of Ramadan, and Eid is basically like showing up on Christmas Day and expecting to be able to work. And so I was struggling in the first few days. And someone who was a press officer at NATO, who had been staying in the same little hotel guest house where all of the journalists stayed, he had kindly advised me. He said, you know, the United Nations have Tim Page, they've flown him in, and he's training Afghan photographers and really helping build a media here, a sense of local Afghan media. And so he would be a great interview and profile piece. And I thought, that's fantastic. So I headed down to the UN in Kabul, and I met with Tim Page. And as you have said, I ended up spending several hours with this man, and he, and in what was meant to be an interview, just ended up becoming this unbelievable conversation of mentorship that I hadn't really even known that I needed. And he is an extraordinary character. He actually just passed away not too long ago. And I was very sad to know that I couldn't send him this book and let him know how he had been, you know, how it had this butterfly effect in my life and my career. And he sat down and he was very much so almost kind of like out of central casting. You know, he was dressed as a war photographer. He was smoking rolled up cigarettes and chatting and drinking coffee. And it felt like it felt almost it felt really, really like I was living in a sort of Hollywood movie. And he just, instead of answering, he'd answer my questions, but largely he would go off on very long soliloquies about how this work should be done and how we should focus on the real countries that we're covering, the people. And I know that sounds obvious now, but you know, when you're a youngster who has these sort of dreams of being a war reporter, you can get kind of caught up in this idea, the identity of it and the coolness of it, and take a picture of me in my flak jacket and I'll have swashbuckling combat stories to tell. But he said to me, you know, we have to put a human face on this war, and instead of saying these are the front lines you need to get to and these are the big battles in Helmand, he said, you know, why do we not go to insane asylums and talk about the mental health crisis here? Why do we not talk about, you know, why do people have these massive weddings and put themselves into debt to keep up with the neighbors? He said, we know so little about these people and their culture, and we're not really communicating it to the people back home. And he also complained that, you know, there wasn't enough reporting on how tough it was for the soldiers, for the American and British soldiers out there. And he, the room just filled up with story ideas that had never occurred to me. And I was fascinated. It occurred to me that this conversation I was having with him was what real journalism was about. And I had come having this idea that I'd be in a foxhole and I would be doing very glamorous bang-bang combat reporting. And in my career, I've done plenty of that. But he reminded me that I was there to report on a country and not a war.
Hmm. And how it affected the people there. So it's not just reporting on bullets through the air and bombs going off, but the cost of that war, the impact of the war on the people there. And beyond,
exactly.
And beyond the combatants, and of course, you have managed to do that in so many different places. Of course, you are doing this work at a time when war is waged in a very different way than it was a generation or two ago. Wars used to be fought in a way with battle lines very clearly delineated, and we're here, and the enemy is there. Just talk for a moment about the supreme challenge, not only for those who wage war and are directly engaged in war, but you and your colleagues trying to cover war in this new era, the way that it is so often fought.
It's definitely worth pointing out the different generations. You know, I was a little too young to be the immediate post 9/11 generation of war reporters who were going to Afghanistan and Iraq in those early days, and they were covering insurgencies and the battle against insurgencies, but with most often with military. So they'll be out on embeds with the American soldiers in Afghanistan, or the British soldiers in Helmand, or in Iraq. You know, so embedded and very often out in the fields with major militaries or with the militaries of those countries, like the Iraqi soldiers or the Afghan soldiers. Now, of course, there were always some reporters who were managing to get deeper out into the field. But generally, broadly speaking, in TV, that's what most journalists were doing. But then my generation really came along. I was just starting out before the Arab Spring started. And so this was a wave of revolutions across the Arab world in 2011 and 12, where dictatorships were being brought down by popular uprisings. And in many cases, dictatorships held on, or the vacuum was filled with warring parties. And so a lot of these initially peaceful revolutions turned into civil wars. And so my generation of reporters were actually used to spending time with the insurgents. Suddenly we're shoulder to shoulder reporting with, Syrian rebels, heading into Yemen and spending time with Houthi rebels. Same in Libya for many reporters. And so that was very much so our challenge as well. On the one hand, incredible access, but on the other hand, you're with the underdogs. You know, you're not with a mighty army, and that is extraordinarily dangerous. So that's definitely been something that has shaped my generation of war reporter. This idea that we are very often with the insurgents, and even though Ukraine has kind of changed a lot of that. You know, when I was in Ukraine, I was so struck by how this was the first time I had ever really covered a conventional war. Because, you know, everybody thought conventional war was over, that essentially it would always be non-conventional combats against insurgencies. So it is a conventional war, but the Ukrainians from the very beginning had been so outgunned by the Russians that in some ways it had that feeling of bands of rebels in the front. That's changing now, of course, because they are so centrally organized and so well equipped by the West. But most of us cut our teeth, you know, reporting alongside young bands of soldiers and fighters who were really, you know, fighting against the odds.
And in a sense, there's something very disconcerting about being with them versus those that are clearly destined to be the victors in a conflict. I mean, there is a certain...
Yeah, and I write about that in Syria, you know, like what it's like to suddenly realize you might be on the losing side today.
Right.
That's very scary.
Yes. Another hallmark of your reporting is that you have not always focused on stories around specifically conflicts and war being waged, but sometimes you have been caught in other kinds of stories. I'm thinking about the humanitarian disaster in Yemen, essentially created by Saudi Arabia, although you talk about America's complicity in that, but covering the way in which so many people's lives were devastated by that, or by the Americans' dramatic and abrupt withdrawal from Afghanistan, covering specifically that kind of story, not specifically about combat as such, but in a sense, the ancillary costs of conflict. What was it like to try to capture stories like that and of that dimension?
You know, the more I was on the road covering conflicts, the more I was just frustrated by the fact that so much of the coverage focused on the casualty rates of the fighting. And it was just so incredible to me to spend time in these communities, in these countries, whether you're in Afghanistan or Somalia or Yemen, and recognize that the war devastates a nation. You know, it's not about, you know, 15,000 dead on the battlefield, because I will know from spending time in hospitals that actually there's 300,000 dead from malnutrition and preventable diseases because the economy collapsed and the healthcare system collapsed. And, you know, there's so little reporting on that. And I over the years, it became a frustration of mine that you know, casualty rates were actually... They were actually much what we were reporting to the public only really was the tip of the iceberg. You know, when you look at people who die as an indirect result of the fighting, it is enormous. And I think that if we could communicate the real costs of war, you know, whenever healthcare systems collapse, you know, in Yemen, cholera came back. It hadn't been in the country for so many generations that doctors had never seen it before. You know, in Yemen, you know, hundreds of thousands of people starved and are starving today because people could no longer afford to buy food. And that was as a result of the fact that the war was also being fought along economic lines. It was also an economic blockade. So that just means, like, you know, so it became a part of my job, and I really was passionate about doing this, showing that, like, you know, I told the story of one little girl whose father was a school teacher. The school teacher stopped getting paid, you know, he hadn't been paid in over a year and a half. And, you know, this is a middle-class family by Yemeni standards. I met his daughter. She almost died the day I arrived in a malnutrition ward in rural Yemen. And, you know, so children are not getting enough nutrients, which makes them more susceptible to diseases. And then when they get the diseases, the hospitals are so wildly underfunded and basically on the brink of collapse, they struggle to treat them. So this is a level of detail and nuance that is often missed in news reporting because it takes time. And it takes more than just sort of scratching the surface of casualty rates. And
absolutely.
So that's something that I was really, really struck by. I lived in Beirut for 6 years. I mean, Lebanon is a country that is so haunted by the war. I mean, by the time I arrived there in 2014, you know, I mean, the war had been over for nearly 25 years, and yet the impact on the country's ability to actually develop and provide any opportunities for young people was so stark that I felt like the echoes of war throughout the years and what it does to societies and nations and individual families, you know, is so much bigger than what happens in the battlefield.
Right. You write at one point, there are so many more who suffer and die due to the unintended consequences of conflict, the collapse of economies and governments, and with these failures, the chances for any decent public health, sanitation, nutrition, or medical care. I mean, we just don't think about those kind of consequences. I know we have very little time left. I do want to ask you about the fact that you are by no means the first, nor are you going to be the last woman to be a war correspondent. But you, of course, have done this work in some places in which women are viewed a certain way that perhaps put you at a bit of a disadvantage or maybe made some of the work you did even more challenging than it would otherwise be. What do you think is most important for us to understand about this facet of your experience as a war correspondent?
It's a complex subject when it comes to the cultures I'm reporting on, and within, because I'm so often in an extraordinarily privileged position. You know, I get treated often as a bit of a third sex. I say this a lot. You know, I'm kind of a strange creature, and myself and my other female colleagues in the field have all felt this, I think, whereby, you know, we're viewed as a sort of exception sometimes. Yes, we're women, but to many of the people around us, they think we're sort of dressed rather like men. We're sort of doing a man's job in the eyes of many of them, and we're foreigners. And so sometimes, because we're sort of these strange alien creatures to some people, we do get a bit of a pass. I'm always so aware that gives me an extraordinary privilege over my female colleagues who are journalists in Afghanistan or in Yemen, you know, or in Somalia, that can massively negate the negative impact of it on me. But there's no denying, you know, that there are certain restrictions in very, very conservative societies. If you're really trying to build contacts, you're really trying to, you know, get into to build relationships with men in positions of power, then, you know, that can be tricky. Sometimes it helps me actually access women as well. You know, I get to talk to wives. I get to hang out in beauty parlors filled with Afghan women. I do get into rooms, and I actually wrote about this in the book. I get in with a female camera woman. I brought a female camera woman who was Canadian with me on my last trip to visit the Taliban in Taliban-controlled areas before they took over Kabul. So this was January, February of 2021. And I did that on purpose because we both put burqas on and get through the government checkpoints with our filming equipment buried underneath and hidden underneath our big burqas. So, you know, we were able to sneak around in that way. But when we were in Taliban-controlled areas, there were times when there was one particular moment where we were able to walk into a house. The Taliban fighters can't come in because there are women there. And so it gives me the opportunity to talk to families where I won't have these gunmen breathing down their necks while they're talking. And that's sort of a rare privilege, which is very helpful. But I also talk about this in the book that, you know, people always ask me, what's it like to be a woman in those cultures? And I answer in the same way that that you and I are discussing right now. But I always remind them that a lot of the pressures on women in the industry come from back home in the industry. You know, it's massively improved now. We have a lot of female executives running and helping to run news organizations. But when I was starting out, so many of the news networks were run by men. And so, you know, that's not problematic in and of itself, but that does mean that on camera, you know, women were very much so viewed through that male lens. And so there's pressure. There's pressure to look a certain way. And that is, I would say, in my day-to-day working life, that had more of an impact on me than the fact that I was working in particularly conservative and patriarchal communities.
Interesting. So there's a couple of different ways in which that played out in complicated fashion. And, of course, you also tell us about what was sometimes the unpleasant reality of being a freelancer. Not only doing this great work, but not always for a very large paycheck, or probably not even certain about where the next paycheck would come from. So I appreciate the unvarnished honesty with which you share really every facet of this important work, which fortunately has ultimately led to tremendous success and honors, including an Emmy, a Peabody, and a George Polk Award, all richly deserved. Your book again, No Ordinary Assignment, a memoir published by Mariner. Jane Ferguson, thank you so much for your great work as a war correspondent and for giving the world this very important book. And thank you for being my morning show guest. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that conversation.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part two of today's program, we're going to touch briefly on the painful issue of hazing in athletic programs, an issue which recently returned to prominence with reports of extensive hazing activity in the football program at Northwestern University, a report which ultimately led to the firing of head football coach Pat Fitzgerald. The following interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2005. I'm really honored and pleased to be speaking for the next few minutes on the morning show with one of my very favorite sports writers, Mike Lupica. I remember so vividly learning so much about my favorite sport, which is tennis, from our morning show guest today. Unfortunately, the topic today, in a sense, is a very unpleasant one, and it's at the heart of a really fascinating and thought-provoking novel, which has just been published, called Too Far. And at the heart and soul of this sports story is the phenomenon of hazing, which is, of course, an all-too-real occurrence across the country. Too Far is published by G.P. Putnam & Sons. And we welcome Mike Lupica to the morning show. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. Before we talk about your book, I wanted to mention something to you, which is that the specter of hazing took on really vivid meaning for a lot of us in this part of the country maybe a year and a half ago because of a very disturbing incident. I don't know if you happen to be aware.
The Powder Puff Touch football game.
Yes, so you are aware of that. For any listeners that didn't know this, this was a number of high school young women who were caught on video engaged in a really horrific incident of hazing. And I think for many of us who didn't know a whole lot about this or never experienced it firsthand, it was a really brutal wake-up call to just how awful hazing is. First of all, what is your sense of the public's awareness of just what kind of a problem this is?
Well, the public's like me. There's a scene in my book where the ex-newspaperman hero, Ben Mitchell, when he first gets the hint from a kid on the high school paper that hazing may be involved in the disappearance of the manager of this high school basketball team. He Googles up hazing in sports, just wanting to educate himself and see just how bad the subject is he was dealing with. And it's exactly what I did after a case, the Mepham High School case, about a year and a half ago, which was a Long Island football team where they went on a preseason training camp in Pennsylvania, and younger members of the team were brutalized by older members of the team. And I was shocked when I read back on this stuff, because it's going on in every state, in every sport, in college, in high school, in frats, in sororities, in boarding schools, in prep schools. There's anti-hazing laws now in 44 states with good reason, because one of the reasons why it's difficult to really get a track on this stuff is, A, some of the victims are afraid to come forward because they don't want their classmates to know what happened to them. And B, and this is much worse, if it happens in sports, they don't want to be viewed as being bad team members for squealing.
Well, and one thing that is striking to me is that this seems to be something that coaches have done little or nothing to stop or even curb. Not all coaches, of course, but there are a fair number of coaches out there, and even a lot of coaches who in maybe every other respect really run a tight ship, who expect their athletes to go to class and get decent grades and wear suit and tie on game day, but will allow this to go on.
The culture of hazing too often is that the victims become the villains in the eyes of the coaches, the school administrators, because why? Because they put the season in peril, and the season is everything. That was one of the big controversies in Memphis. People were worried that something might happen to their precious football team, which it finally did. The season got canceled. The coach got fired. Two of the kids got prosecuted in juvenile court, and it's a tragedy that will resonate in that town for years and years and years. In my book, I said it in high school basketball. It's about a high school team that's going to be the best in the country. It's sort of going to be like LeBron James' high school team.
You say it's the
LeBron,
You say it's the biggest thing that has ever happened to this little town. The impending success of this team.
And my hero becomes the bad guy along with a kid on the high school paper, because they're going to try to figure out who did it. And the town is more worried that these guys are coming in to upset the apple cart. Listen, I wouldn't be telling people to read it if it wasn't a good read. I mean, this book has been. I got a letter of praise on this book from Patricia Cornwell herself, who actually helped me edit it a little bit, and said she couldn't figure out what happened. So it's a good read.
Yeah, no, it absolutely.
People are going to learn a lot about hazing.
I'm curious why you chose to approach this topic in the form of a novel. Another way, of course, to do this would be more in the nonfiction arena. What tools were yours as a novel writer that maybe would not have been if you'd written about this in another way?
Because what I find is about 8 or 9 years ago, I wrote a novel, a mystery novel called Jump, which was about a rape in professional sports and who you believe, the athlete or the young woman, which became very prescient. It was amazing. I thought they should have brought it back out when the Kobe thing was happening, because it was so prescient about. And the only reason I wrote that book is because I knew that if the material was in my hands, for once I'd know exactly what happened. And so I wanted to be in control of a situation where there wasn't going to be any doubt at the end of the book. Hmm. People would know exactly what happened, exactly who was telling the truth, exactly who the bad guys were, and be rooting along with my hero for the bad guys to get theirs, which they do in this book.
Right. One of the interesting things that happens here is that the student that approaches your central character, the journalist who goes after this story, the only reason this student sort of got wind of what had occurred with this hazing incident with the basketball team was that one of those young athletes that had been around was drunk and upset one night and quite accidentally sort of let the cat out of the bag, at least to some extent. I suppose that plays out in real life quite often, too, that it is only in the most inadvertent of ways that many hazing incidents ever come to light.
Right. Sometimes it never comes out. And then, of course, in the book, as you see, then another kid, the injuries from what was done to him become so apparent that he can't keep it a secret anymore, which is one of the ways that the Mepham High School thing came out. The parents said to this boy, how could you have possibly sustained an injury like this? And finally the kid breaks down and tells them what had happened to him at the preseason camp, or maybe we never would have known about this. Hmm.
Your journalist character, Ben Mitchell, is walking into this story carrying some baggage, actually having kind of left the business that he was in because of a very upsetting incident that involved him kind of unleashing to the world some very embarrassing information about someone else. And in the wake of what occurs, this journalist ends up sort of quitting the business. I'm curious why you wanted to set that very compelling storyline against this other storyline.
Well, which a few years ago, you may not remember this, maybe you do, there was a manager of the Toronto Blue Jays named Tim Johnson, who had been in the service but completely fabricated a Vietnam War history for himself as a way of motivating his team, when it turned out he'd never been to Vietnam. And I always thought that was I sort of thought that would be an interesting novel once. And as I read back on that, I find that there are a lot of celebrities who fabricated war records, and I was surprised to find out it's harder than you think to go back. I mean, we found out with John Kerry to find the truth of somebody's war circumstances, okay? And so in my book, and I'm not really spoiling anything because this kind of happens pretty early on.
Right.
Ben Mitchell, my hero, has written a column about a fictitious manager of the Dodgers who did the same thing. He gets the goods on him. He confronts him. The guy begs him not to tell what happened. Mitchell said, if I know, anybody's going to know. I'm just giving you a chance to respond and to apologize. The guy said, I can't do that, and he ends up killing himself because he can't deal with what he thinks is going to be the fallout. That is enough to push Mitchell out of the business once and for all. He goes back to his small town on Long Island where he grew up, and it just so happens that that's where the action of the book takes place. But I thought it's an interesting moral dilemma for people in the media. What are the possible consequences of what I'm going to write? And so the action of the book for Mitchell begins with that, and then over the course of the book, he remembers that when you do your work responsibly, that newspapers can still do good work, and he remembers why he loved the business in the first place as he goes after the punks who did this in Too Far.
Hmm. You know, one of the striking things in that, when he recounts that conversation with this coach, confronting him, saying he's about to reveal these embarrassing facts to the public, and when this coach begs him not to, he says, anybody could know it, as you say. But then he goes on to say, and I'm not going to be beat on this story.
Right.
I mean,
be first.
That also gives us a sense of the almost brutal aggressiveness that, of course, can be part of the world of journalism.
Oh, yeah, there's editors that we hear about in our, you know, in our business now, who say, listen, just be first. We'll sort out later how right your information is. So it's one of the things that you know, is the more I go on in the newspaper business, the more sad I am sometimes to see what it's become. It's not the business that I got into about 30 years ago, believe me.
So back to hazing for just our closing moments.
Sure.
Do you have any sense that this awful phenomenon in any way is in retreat? I mean, we are at least talking about it a bit more, and certainly these harsh punishments, which are handed out, and rightfully so, one would hope are making at least some kind of difference. What is your sense as a sports writer?
Well, it was such a horrific story in Meffam. You know, that touch football game with the girls down in Illinois, that was so horrific. I hope it's in decline, but then every couple of months you'll pick up the paper and see that in a fraternity initiation, a kid drank himself to death in Colorado, and these stories still happen. Some kids at St. John's University just got off for being accused of paddling a kid so hard that they caused kidney damage. People have to come forward. It's one of the good things about this book. I'm telling this story because I think people don't know how pervasive the culture. Oh, and even in boarding schools. Groton up in Massachusetts, a big-time la-di-da boarding school. You know, there were incidents of hall monitors abusing kids that just came to light. So I'm hoping that we can shine a light on it and put it in decline, as you say.
The book is Too Far, published by G.P. Putnam & Sons. Mike Lupica, I congratulate you on a great, great book. And it was great
Thank
to talk
you
to you
so
on the morning
much.
Show. Tomorrow on the morning show, an interesting conversation about the food we eat with Yuna Jatta, co-author of Food We Need to Talk, the science-based, humor-laced last word on eating, diet, and making peace with your body.
On Wednesday, we look forward to a conversation with Amy Grile, Executive Director of the Kenosha Community Foundation, talking about their good work. On Thursday, best-selling author Steve Barry, famous for his wonderful thrillers, talks about his most recent book, which is called The Ninth Man. And this Friday, we'll end this week of morning shows with our good friend Dr. Art Sear, joining us for his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of a variety of current events and issues. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find the program archive.